on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
And we can take that imagery and apply it to our own challenges that we're going through, whether it's a divorce or a loss of a job or moving to a new area. You know, we all go through stuff all our lives. And so being able to look at these symbols and these stories and say, hey, you know, I can relate with that. Or for me, it was diving into a cavern, and or for this person over here, it's really water-based and it's the deep, or it's the cauldron and the vessel. It's all this beautiful mythic imagery that we are lucky to have throughout our lives that can really uplift us and show us, not necessarily show us the way, but help us feel included, help us relate, help us think, okay, what's next on my journey? If you're in a pit of despair and you're having a really hard time, it's hard to think, okay, this will pass and what's coming next will be better. And so these stories, I think, really give us a gift of, you know, the journey, the process, but also this imagery that is really rich and fertile.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I'm joined by author Holly Bellabono to discuss her latest book, Once Upon a Place. Inspired by the symbolism of places and personal growth narratives, the book explores five key symbolic places, the cavern, the deep, the vessel, the forest, and the labyrinth, as integral to human quests and transformation. Holly shares insights on how these themes relate to myths, the hero's journey, and how they reflect the human experience of overcoming challenges. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Greetings, Nick here. Before I begin this week's episode, I wanted to make a request that you follow or subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know this is in the intro every week and you just heard it. But right now, for example, the stats on the platform I use to distribute the podcast shows that 10 people follow the podcast in its audio version. And one of those people is me. But I know I have way more listeners than that. I'm nearing 200 episodes, and I'm not quite at 2,000 followers yet on YouTube. So if you enjoy what I'm doing here on Rebel Spirit Radio, please take a second to help me out. Subscribing or following is totally free and only takes a few seconds of your time, and it will really help the podcast grow, and I will be immensely grateful. So now, on to my interview with Holly Bellabono about her book, Once Upon a Place. Holly Bellabono is an entrepreneur and herbalist of 30 years. Through courses, workshops, and retreats, she guides people to think creatively about success, business, healing, and purpose. A regular contributor to Llewellyn's Herbal Almanacs, Bellabono is also the author of An Herbalist Guide to Formulary and Llewellyn's Little Book of Herbs. She joins me today to discuss her latest book, Once Upon a Place. Holly, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to the conversation. I was very interested in the book just based on the title, because personally, I always like this idea of connection to land and connection to place. So we'll get into this a little bit. But my first question for you is, it seems like it's a little bit of a different book for you. So what led you to write this?
Yeah, all my previous books, this is my eighth. All my others are herbal medicine. So I run an herbal medicine school. All my books are nonfiction herbal, how to use botanical therapeutics for health. And this one is very different. It's philosophy. It's diving into magic. It's looking at imagery and symbolism in literature and beyond. To be honest, it came to me out of the middle of nowhere. I had just sold an herbal apothecary that I had run for years, sold it, did all the financials behind that, finished all my taxes for the year. And literally, I was standing in my living room and I looked around and I said, what's next? And this entire book came into my head. Not wow. Complete, of course, yeah. But the basics of it, the ideas of place, the ideas of the heroine's journey, the idea of water and how it is such an important element in these stories of quests and adventures and personal transformation, how it shows up in our own lives. It all just came in like instantly. So I don't know if you've ever read anything by Elizabeth. Oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name now. She wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about. I don't know her last name, but I'm familiar. Yeah.
I know her very well. And for some reason, I'm blanking on. She wrote Big Magic. And she talks about where ideas come from and the whole creative process, and that these little ideas are like little entities that come and latch on to a person at the right time. And I feel like that's kind of what happened to me with this book. But it is, in a way, related to plants and botanicals, because it's the journey of a seed. You know, when people go through this transformation process, it's very similar to what plants do. They drop a seed. It sits down in the dirt for a long time, in the dark. It finally rises up again and it sprouts. So it's that symbolic imagery.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I like that. And I want to get into some of the ideas that you have in the book. But just to comment on this idea of the seed and the plants, I've often thought, and I think that this is pretty valid, that most of our religions, or the earliest religions, were based on agriculture and the development of agriculture and the growth of plants.
And I briefly touch on that in the book, that it's this idea of growth and a seed going through hardship. A lot of the ancient Egyptian myths are based on scattering seeds, winnowing seeds, and then planting them. So it's a very familiar image, and it's something I think that has really influenced the way we tell stories.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, and speaking of Egypt, and you do mention this in the book, you know, the god Osiris is kind of torn apart and spread about as well, and is then kind of reborn. I know there are different versions of the myth. You know, he tends to stay in the underworld, though, for the most part. It's an interesting book because you focus on what is typically referred to as a hero's journey. And I know that that is very kind of gendered. It kind of leaves out that there are heroines as well. So you refer to this as the world journey instead. And the hero's journey, the world journey, excuse me, is pretty well known. And it is, you know, I know Joseph Campbell referred to it as the monomyth, that most of our myths are this journey story. But the story is also about personal transformation, right?
Yes. So there are a variety of different types of stories. There are morality tales. There are origin myths that show how the sun came to be or how a turtle came to be. And then there are quests, or this type of adventure, which really kind of neatly fits into Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. He spoke about the process, how a person goes through stages in their lives or multiple times throughout their lives to achieve enlightenment or maturity. And it's all about the process, which is wonderful. I really like that. I'm a big Joseph Campbell fan. However, as you mentioned, it is typically a hero and not a heroine going through this process. And so I wanted to involve the feminine in there and show just how women go through this type of journey frequently throughout their lives. And I also wanted to look at not so much the process of maturity or growth, but where it happens, because that hasn't really been explored. So that's why it's Once Upon a Place, and it explores the five, what I discovered and posit are the five key places that happen in pretty much any quest: the cavern, the deep, the vessel, the forest, and the labyrinth. And they're symbolic. You know, in the stories, the character goes into these, and we are living the journey through the character when we read a story or watch a movie. But they really influence what the character does and what they think and the decisions they make and whether they come through it alive or not. And we can take that imagery and apply it to our own challenges that we're going through, whether it's a divorce or a loss of a job or moving to a new area. You know, we all go through stuff all our lives. And so being able to look at these symbols and these stories and say, hey, you know, I can relate with that. Or for me, it was diving into a cavern, or for this person over here, it's really water-based and it's the deep, or it's the cauldron and the vessel. It's all this beautiful mythic imagery that we are lucky to have throughout our lives that can really uplift us and show us, not necessarily show us the way, but help us feel included, help us relate, help us think, okay, what's next on my journey? If you're in a pit of despair and you're having a really hard time, it's hard to think, okay, this will pass and what's coming next will be better. And so these stories, I think, really give us a gift of, the journey, the process, but also this imagery that is really rich and fertile and we don't think about very often. And so that's part of the reason I wrote the book, is so that we can think about this and say, oh yeah, this is really core to what I'm going through.
And you mentioned water, and I've always understood water, one kind of interpretation of it in these stories and myths is the unconscious. And I think that a lot of this symbolism of the places even appear in dreams. I know the last one that you discuss in the book is the labyrinth. And for me, I've had many dreams where I've been in a not a physical labyrinth, but the labyrinth for me in my dreams is like a shopping mall that has all sorts of ways to go around. And then sometimes like housing, where all of these houses are connected, and I'm going through windows and various doors. And it really speaks to where I was at a point in my life. So it seems like these images, if we pay attention to dreams, they can also help guide us that way as well.
It's interesting you say that because I've had very similar dreams throughout my life about being in houses where I'm in a house and I go through a room and then a closet and then another room and down a hallway and then there's a secret room and then there's a secret attic. It's that kind of labyrinth type imagery. And I think that's symbolic of a lot of things that we experience in our lives, from the Underground Railroad when people were literally traveling through a labyrinthine process to get their freedom. From one house to another, to a cave, to a chapel, whatever. And, symbolically, we're going through the same process where we might go through job and then another job and then unemployment and then a job after that. And it's just that symbolism where we can picture ourselves, and it's the human experience. It's not just one person, it's all of us experiencing this kind of mental or emotional journey.
And it's not something that we do just once. We tend to repeat this as well, I think,
And
various times in our lives.
yeah, it's interesting. When I was writing the book, a lot of stories are based on puberty. So a child growing into an adult and the massive change they go through. There are a lot of myths and fairy tales devoted to that time in a young person's life. But then there are other events in our lives that happen all throughout our lives, no matter how old we are. And it's the same transformation, it's the same growth and epiphany and learning and maturity throughout our entire lives.
Absolutely. I agree with that. It's initiatory, I think. You talk about that most of these stories are kind of telling about a descent and resurrection. And I always think about initiation, which is very similar. It's a new beginning, I think, is kind of the literal meaning of initiation, is to begin again.
Yeah, the descent and resurrection is a huge theme in this book. It's what I call a dual concept. It's one of those dualities where the two sides of the coin are really interwoven, descent, and then you rise up again. And that's really the core of the theme. It is, you go down and you experience the challenges and then you rise up or ascend. The other dualities, there are two others in the book that are really essential. One is chaos and void. The idea of, in a lot of stories and films, especially today, you'll see just chaotic wilderness places where the character is trying to find a path or a trail or a road or a signpost, and there's nothing. It's just chaos. It's, filled and hard to get your bearings. The other side of that is void, which there's nothing. There's no trail or road or signpost because it's all empty. But really, it's the same image. It's the front and back of the exact same image. It relates our confusion, our panic, our uncertainty. And it's a key theme in these quest and adventure stories that adds to the plot and the fun of reading a story, but it's also very inherent in, hey, this is what we all go through, we all experience. And it's really difficult to change if you don't experience one of those. If you're not feeling chaos or complete emptiness and isolation, there are trigger points that really get you to the next stage. And then the third dual image is the beast and the guide. And that's a really key thing in all of these quest stories, is that you come across, whether it's a person or an animal or some sort of fairy or figure, you come across something that's going to challenge you. And you also usually come across somebody who's going to help you. So that dual image is really essential throughout the book as well.
And I see that in a lot of the heroine journey stories as well. And also in dreams. Also in dreams, I get these beasts and these guides. Now, you had mentioned triggers, and this is kind of part of the process of the world journey. I'm going to try to be mindful and say that instead of hero's journey, that the hero or heroine, there's something that triggers this journey. And what are some of these triggers? You already mentioned one, which is puberty and the kind of the desire to mature a little bit. What are the other triggers?
So puberty is interesting because it's thrust upon you. You can't avoid it. If you continue growing, you will go through puberty. The other ones are more enigmatic in a way. Some of them, a person is seeking to avert death. That's a big one. So like there's Gilgamesh, one of our most ancient stories, right? And he probably would never have gone out on his quest, his adventure, had his friend not died. So he was a warrior or a fighter, and he and his friend had all these adventures together. And then his friend dies, and he's in denial. He's like looking at his friend's body and doesn't quite comprehend that he's gone. And this is kind of gross, but this is part of the tale, until he sees a worm fall out of his friend's nose and he realizes it's a corpse. He's actually dead. And then he gets the idea that could happen to me. I could actually die. I'm not immortal. And that's the trigger that sets him out on this quest to find the ancient persona of Noah from the flood, basically. Noah was given immortality by the gods. And so Gilgamesh wants to go find him and say, how do I become immortal too? So that was his trigger, is averting mortality. And that tends to be what a lot of the stories are, is a person wants to live. They don't want to die. So they go on this quest to learn or to gain knowledge or wisdom. Another trigger is that they want to find out information about their loved ones. So there are tales where someone will try to go to the underworld to have a conversation, to learn, is my relative here, are they okay? Will I see them again? So that can be the basis for some of these other stories. There are a number of triggers. And then there are some stories like Maidkin. I call her Maidkin. Some people know the story as Frau Holly. It's a German folk tale of a girl who drops her spindle into a well and jumps in after the spindle. That's her trigger, is to get it, but really it's to grow and mature, because when she meets Frau Holly, she learns about hard work and work ethic and becomes a stronger person, basically. So there are a number of different triggers, and they range, and they totally focus on what we all experience ourselves. We are confused. We wonder about our loved ones. What happens after they die? Will we ever see them again? Will I really die myself? And so these human experience, these really deep, tender emotions can trigger this type of growth process and personal transformation.
I always liked, having studied some of this idea, I learned it as not a trigger, but a call. Sometimes there's this call to adventure, and the hero or heroine has, they can either accept it or reject it. But often, if they reject it, it comes down on their heads anyway. And I think a couple of really good examples of that is, like Luke Skywalker in Star Wars. He wants to go out on an adventure, but he feels stuck. And he tells, Ben Kenobi at first, I can't go. But then his aunt and uncle are killed, and that is what leads him to go. My other favorite is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, just to give a female perspective. They do have an episode where they show when she is kind of called to be the Slayer. And, you know, this guide of sorts comes up and he says, you know, you are a vampire slayer. You know, this is your destiny. And her response is, no, I think I'm destiny free. But, you know, she can't avoid it. It has to happen that way.
Yeah, a lot of it is identity, right? Who are
Yeah,
you really? And you may
right.
be this one person now, but your identity or your destiny is calling for you to grow into this new phase or version of yourself so that you really are complete and whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's what it is. It's all about our personal growth at all the different stages of our lives. And we can try to stay where we are, but we can't. We can't.
It would be really sad if that's what
Yeah.
happened, right? We have
Yeah,
to
yeah.
grow and change. If I was the same person I was at 20, I'd be having a lot of fun out in
Yeah.
the woods a lot, which was great, but I wouldn't have the breadth and depth of understanding and emotion and growth that I've experienced, and it would be a real loss.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. Why don't we start looking at some of these places? And I found it fascinating because people do know the process of the hero's journey, the heroine's journey, the world journey, but the place itself is not often examined. And I think it's really important. So we have, and you've already mentioned them, we've got the abyss, the cavern, the deep, the vessel, the forest, and the labyrinth. Let's talk a little bit about the abyss, because you said that the abyss and the void, right? No, chaos and the void. The abyss, that's watery, or no, wait, that's not. Explain it
Okay, so in
to
my mind, the abyss is all of them.
me.
The
Okay,
abyss
all right.
is that general location,
Okay, all right.
is the experience. In the way back past, you know, primordial past, the abyss was called the ocean. But
Yeah.
in this sense, the abyss is everything, and then within that everything are these five locations
Okay.
specifically.
All right. All right. All right. Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, the coffee's still kicking in, so I'm a little rusty here. So, all right. So we have the cavern, which is like the cave.
Yes.
And I loved that the when you began that chapter, you mentioned Chauvet Cave and these old Paleolithic caves with all these amazing paintings and drawings. And Chauvet is amazing because it had been like hermetically sealed for so long. And I think it's dated to like 32,000 BCE. And often the caves, we think these Paleolithic caves served as points of initiation.
Most likely, they
Yeah.
were such an important piece of ritual and ceremony for ancient peoples. They're very symbolic just in of themselves. They represent, to me at least, they seem to represent the womb, place from which you originate. They're very core to who we are. And then I mentioned in the book, you know, it's easy to go down into a cave or a hole. Kids do it all the time. They love to play in holes. They love to scramble underneath tree roots and find what's dark and under. And the whole idea of the underworld has been a fascinating image throughout literature and history. It's very easy to imagine what's under, and especially that a cave has a sort of shape about it. It's a cauldron or a chalice is another location in the book. It's the vessel, but a cave is kind of vessel-like in many ways. It has an opening, you go down into something that's finite, and then you come out. When I was caving, I used to do spelunking a little bit in
Yeah.
college and loved going down into these caves. And there was one passageway that was so narrow, we called it the birth canal because you literally could barely squeeze through it. And then you emerge into the woods and it's daylight and it's very birth-like. So it's a really ready image for transformation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the cavern, would that are there other forms of it other than caves? I'm thinking, like, for example, you talk several times about Alice in Wonderland when she goes down the rabbit hole. Would that be another example of a cavern?
I think so. Yeah. The Alice in Wonderland story, she goes down and down and down and down and down. And
Right.
it's not a vessel necessarily. It's an ongoing descent. And the same thing with Jules Verne, he just goes down and down and you end up in this new world in the under underworld. So it doesn't have to have that shape. It's the idea of darkness and descent. And I think those are the key things. You're descending, you're eventually going to have to come back up, and it's dark. When I was spelunking in those caves in North Carolina and Tennessee and Virginia, the thing that just grabbed me so much was how incredibly dark it was. I mean, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. It was so dark, it was disconcerting. It was that chaos void effect. You really haven't got a clue where you are, almost who you are. It's mind shifting. And so then to rise up out of that it's an awakening experience.
And it seems like it would be just a little bit off topic. It would be pretty amazing to do that in the Appalachians, because I think those are like the one of the oldest mountain chains in the world. And so it seems like there's going to be some kind of very old and powerful energy in those caves.
It's amazing. I would love to go do it again. It was a phenomenal experience the few times I was able to do it. And it really gives you a sense of where people long time ago got these stories or developed these images for their storytelling, because it has such an impact on the psyche and on children reading these tales. It's mind-blowing.
And one of the older myths that we have, I mean, I think the oldest that we have in writing, I think some of the myths are a little bit older, but would be the myth of Inanna going into the underworld. And that's the Sumerian, I believe. Or is she the Arcadian and Ishtar is the Sumerian? I always kind of
Yeah, I
forget
kind of get
those
them
two.
mixed up. In the book, I kind of conflated them for convenience. I mean,
That happens actually. Other people do that too.
but yeah, and her trigger honestly is kind of lost to us. Like, why did she go in the first place? We're not quite sure, but she ends up visiting the underworld. Her sister Arish-Kagul is the queen of the underworld, and it's unclear why she wants to visit. Is she trying to get information? Is she trying to usurp her sister? Can't quite tell, but she ends up dying and having to be rescued by a guide who leads her back out again. And it's the seasonal myth. So now there's winter, there's summer, there's fruit and harvest, or there's famine. So she was the basis of that myth, and it's the underworld for sure. It's dark, it's cold, and at least in those myths, there is no coming out of it. She was able to come out because she was an immortal goddess. But generally, when people go to the underworld, when people die, that's it. You're gone. And that's why these stories, this symbolism of going down and then rising again, it's a very immortality type image, because if it happened literally, you would die. But this is a symbolic journey, and it's all about growth and mental perseverance and your identity, like we talked about. So it's a very symbolic type of living again, and you've got this second chance.
And she had to, the only way she was actually able to leave is because she had to find a replacement. And it ended up
Right.
being her husband, Dumuzi, or Tamuzi.
Right.
You see both of those names. One thing, and this doesn't really, I don't think it helps answer the question of why she went down, but I know in the, at least the Ishtar version, there's a connection to the Epic of Gilgamesh. Because one of the things that Ishtar wants, she kind of presents herself to Gilgamesh and says, "Hey, be my husband," and he rejects her. And they end up slaughtering, he and Enki do, this is before he dies, they slaughter the bull of heaven. And people are like, "Well, I don't know what that is." Well, the bull of heaven was Eriş-Kagul's husband. And that's why Eriş-Kagul, at least in this ver that version, is so angry at Ishtar, is because she kind of led to the death of her husband.
And there were mourning rites and rituals for hundreds, if not thousands of years, mourning Dumuzi and people who were loyal to him. And that reminds me of the Persephone tale as well from ancient Greece, because she goes down to the underworld unwillingly. Again, probably another puberty story. We've got imagery of, the red pomegranate seeds and probably a rape. And she becomes not only queen of the dead, but wife of, oh gosh, help me out.
Hades.
Duties, thank you. And she doesn't have to get anyone to take her place. It's more a story of Demeter, really, her mother, who goes into mourning and is freaking out, where is my daughter? She disappeared. And all the things that Demeter does in the community trying to find her. Really fascinating tale of what Demeter does. But basically, Persephone went down named Kore, which just means girl, and comes out Persephone. So it's a name change, identity again. It's personal growth, and then it's the seasons. So because she ate a certain number of pomegranate seeds, she has to return for a certain number of months, and then that correlates with the seasons of the year. So it's just a beautiful tale, but it's a female version of a quest, which is really fascinating.
And it's that was also the basis of the Indian mysteries, and we don't know much about them, but we've been told that people, the main temple, the I think it's called the Telesterion or something, it was different than other Greek temples because it was entirely enclosed. And that seems to represent that womb or the abyss, you know, the cavern, the cave, and that they would have this experience of seeing the sun at like midnight. And so there is that sense of coming up out of the cavern as well for initiates into that tradition, we
From the darkness into the
think.
light. Yeah.
One of the things kind of going on, there's a, you talk about wells and water is really important. And I'm kind of fascinated with the wells for a couple of reasons, but let me ask you the significance of the wells. The well, this it's different than the cavern.
Yeah, so there are two ways that water shows, well, there are many multiple ways that water shows up, but in my book I really focus on two. There's the deep, which is the ocean, like Gilgamesh dove into the ocean, vast, deep, boundaryless practically. And then there are vessels, and the well can be a vessel, or it can be a cauldron or a chalice. And a lot of times, I mean, in the book I go over all the fairies and the sprites that inhabit the wells or bless people who come to the wells. But one thing that was interesting to me was the surface of the well or the chalice, the water is very reflective, you know. And so you've got the Nordic ancient Vikings sending their dead on pyres on boats across the surface of the water when they die. So that's a journey of death. You've got images of the reflection from the water, where you look at yourself, like in Lord of the Rings, right? That was really nice with Galadriel's. Well, you've got the Celtic cauldron myths of Ceridwen, where she's brewing inside her cauldron. So it's not so much the surface, it's what's brewing. You've got Gaelic myths of Finnegan or Finnegas, different versions, where the salmon are swimming in the spring underneath the hazel tree, and someone is trying to catch the fish of wisdom, the salmon of wisdom, but the boy comes up and takes a bite instead. You know, it's all that kind of watery magic that is so fun. And it really plays a key part in this sense of place, this sense of transformation through setting and where you are.
And I think that my interest in the well is I noticed that it appears not always going into the well. And you talk about some of those myths, and they're really amazing. But I noticed, like in the story of Demeter and Persephone, when Demeter is in her mourning journey and she finally makes her way to Eleusis, she stops by a well. And I think in the, is it Plutarch? He has the Isis version where she's searching for, you know, her husband Osiris. She stops at a well. And when you look at the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, when Moses leaves Egypt and goes out into the desert, he stops at a well. And you also see that with some of the patriarchs, they stop at a well. And it seems to be
And
this like
Miriam.
universal image.
Yeah. Miriam, all the way to Brigid, you know, it's the wells are sacred and they're amazing. And it's that, for me, it's that idea of water is this magical substance and it fills up this cavity in the earth or in a cauldron or whatever where you can't see the bottom. And if you look in the top, you can see yourself. And living beings can live in that, and we can't. It's just this phenomenal substance. It's this magical mercurial element that leads toward introspection and pause. Like you said, they stopped by the well, they paused. You're waiting, you're asking, you're thinking. It's a place of decision making and potential. Right? There's so much potential. And in our own lives, we could make 1,000 different decisions, but the one we make is the one that puts us on our next chart. Right? And if we just made a different decision, our lives would be completely different. And I think water has that effect to us. So many of these tales are based on water, whether it's deep or shallow, whether it's churning and full of bubbles or it's calm. Beowulf had a little bit of both, right? It had churning waters where and the sword was dropped, but then it's also this calm sea where decisions are made. And it's a story of warriors and fighting, but it's still decision making for a person. It's that growth experience. So it water, especially the wellsprings and the vessels, are just fascinating.
And water is also symbolic of life. You know, we can't live without water, and we know that life came out of water. And I know that in the ancient, a lot of the ancient creation stories, that was the beginning point is water. And kind of going back again to Babylon, their creation myth, the Enuma Elish, begins with water.
Yeah, violently with water. You've got that, who is the abyss. That's her name. And she is the ocean or water or whatever you want to imagine her as. And there was nothing else until somehow she births, the virgin birth very early, children and then grandchildren. And then it's Marduk, her one, I think it's her grandchild, who rises up against her and slays her and thereby creates land, form from formlessness, and water is key to all of that.
And that sneaks into the Old Testament Genesis, the very beginning. I think a lot of people don't quite catch this, that you know, the very beginning, they think that God creates out of nothing, but there's not nothing. There's water. And this is before the creation of the earth, where God is going over the face of the waters. And in the Bible, it actually says the deep, and the Hebrew word for that is Tehom, which is cognate with Tiamat.
Oh, isn't that fascinating? And then Marduk was the god of air, right? He attacks the water with windstorms. And in the Bible, it's the breath of God, right? So it's all air versus water. It's that imagery from way back.
And it's it also is the same because Tiamat is, you know, after Marduk slaughters her, he cuts her in half, not, you know, half, you know, midway, but like lengthwise. And, you know, part of her becomes the earth and the other part becomes the firmament. And the firmament is what keeps the cosmic waters out. And we see that same thing in Genesis as well. God creates a firmament to keep the waters out. And you also see it in Egypt with Nut, who is her body is the firmament.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And going back, I actually had this great conversation. I was in my process of writing the book talking about primordial waters. I was reading about Tiamat and Marduk and learning about this ancient water-based religion or philosophy, and I get a phone call. And the phone call is it was from a I didn't know who it was, but it was in this old phone where I could see the caller ID, and it said Pure Water, PUR Water. Okay, I'll answer it. And it was a salesperson selling water purification devices. And I was like, well, I don't want to buy anything, but it's so fascinating that you called because I'm working on water right now. And so we started talking, and I said, so how are sales? And he said, well, they're not very good in the US, but they're great in the Middle East. And it was just
That's interesting.
this throwback to these ancient tales that I was reading about at the moment.
It sounds like a wonderful synchronicity there. Yeah. So I wanted to, I know that we're starting to run out of time here. So there are a few things that I wanted to look at. And one of them was the forest. And that was actually one of the things that really drew me to your work. And because I like the idea of the forest and the forest as a place of transformation. And I wanted to ask you about the forest, but you make a point, maybe this is a good place to begin with this, is the distinction between a single tree and the forest.
Yeah, so a single tree is beautiful. We've got poetry about a single tree. We've all sat against the trunk of a tree, I hope, and have just relaxed and rested and felt the ancientness of that tree. And it can form a signpost or a meeting place when you're in an area and you want to find a spot, right? But a forest of trees is an entirely different image. Let me go back to the single tree. So the single tree, it's also a portal. You've got the roots going down into the earth, you've got the branches going up into the sky. It's an image of transportation as well as transformation. People rever the tree. There's the gallows tree, there's the tree of life in the Bible. There are all sorts of individual trees that have been endowed in our minds and in literature with these special characteristics based on the tree's ability to connect the underworld and the upper world. And then a forest of trees is less that embodiment and more, at least in my mind, chaos. And going into the deep, going into the abyss, going into the darkness. There are a lot of stories and tales that talk about, you lose your way, you become disoriented in the woods, in the forest. And it's a huge image in fairy tales, of course, which is why it's so resonant in our imaginations, because we all grow up with these stories of people going into the woods, and that's where their transformation takes place. That's where the hideous beasts are. That's where you can get eaten. And we haven't even talked about consummation and the idea of sacrifice. But yeah, the forest is a key central location of the abyss. And it can be mesmerizing, partly because it's made up of all these individual trees that are in and of themselves portals, and partly because it creates an atmosphere of confusion and fear, which is where we go emotionally when we're having a hard time or facing a challenge.
No, I liked it because I have this, part of my background is in religion and ecology and wilderness as a theme. And when I teach this in classes, I kind of go over the etymology of wilderness, but technically it's where the wild things live. And I always quote the Marie Sendak book, just to see if students catch it. But, that's so deep. And that's one of like the best-selling children's books. I just saw an exhibit. Denver Art Museum has an exhibit of Marie Sendak's work right now. And according to them, that is the most checked out book in the New York library system.
Wow,
Yeah.
really?
And so it's still is a very vital symbol of, this wilderness and where the wild things are. But let's talk a minute. We haven't, you mentioned the consuming things and sacrifice. And I think talking about that along with the beasts is kind of important. So what is the
Yeah.
relevance of consummation and sacrifice?
That's a big exploration in my book is the beast. So we're in reality going through hard times, and maybe there's a person or a system that's holding us back. In literature and symbolically, we put a name to that or a face to that. We make it a wolf or a witch or a serpent. Those tend to be the three, although, it can come in any form. And the beast is there to challenge you. And if you're not challenged, you're not going to grow. You're just not going to change. You have to be challenged in real life and in stories. So we talked about the beast and the guide. The beast, as I mentioned in the book, is not there, however, to give you a slap on the wrist or be a minor challenge. The beast is there to be a huge, ferocious challenge that you really have to Look inward and ask yourself questions in order to get past it. And there's this idea of being consumed by the beast. So Little Red Riding Hood is eaten by the wolf. Jonah is eaten by the whale. Saint George bites the dragon because the dragon was going to eat the bride. So it's this idea of being eaten, but being eaten is not being killed. You don't die. In these stories, it's symbolic because being eaten is a consummation, it's a change, it's a complete rendering of your entire existence because you come back out. And I mentioned in the book, if eating is an act of, it's a social act for us. We eat with each other, we break bread, we eat things that used to be alive, whether plants or animals, and they sustain us, they nourish us. And it's very similar in these tales that even though you're facing a beast and you're being eaten or consumed, it's a positive change if you do it correctly, if you make the right decisions, if you learn and grow in a really positive way. And then there's also the idea of consummation for a marriage. The whole idea of, being married, your wedding night, you perform the sex act, and it's this change. The girl becomes a woman, the boy becomes a man, you both become husband or wife. It's an entire change of your identity. And it's consuming one part of you, the childish part, and releasing you into your more mature part. So the idea of you sacrifice yourself to the beast in order for this to happen. And it's not an evil type of craziness and sacrifice in that term, that sense of the word. It's a positiveness, it's a reawakening, it's a moving forward in your life through your identity, or as you said earlier, your destiny.
I found it really interesting. You noted in the book that in the French, I think that when a woman loses her virginity, they say something like, that she was eaten by the wolf or taken by the wolf or something like that.
Yeah, that's the euphemism in France. It's an old.
That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And consumption is so important because, even in, for example, Christianity, the main ritual is based on consumption.
Yeah, you mean the Eucharist, and yeah, we're very symbolic that way. We've been doing it for a long time. Inherently, we recognize that we take in what we need, or that we are taken in by the beast in order to change. It's really all about allowing yourself to change, recognizing what the right changes are in your life. I had so much fun with the symbolism and imagery in this book, and researching the literature and the history behind everything. But in the end, it's really about personal growth and transformation and becoming a better person.
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you if you could share one of the stories. I mean, we've kind of talked about a lot of the common stories, but you had one that you said was your favorite. And that was the Ethiopian story of Mesiti and the lion's whisker. So I thought that I could ask you to sort of share that story because I found it a really interesting story as well.
Isn't it a fun one? It is one of my favorites that I came across. And I named her Mesiti because in the legends I read, there was no name. It was just the woman. So I gave her a name. So a husband and a wife are having difficulty and their marriage is on the rocks. And the wife wants to save the marriage and do something about it. She's really unsure what to do. So she goes to the village elder who says, I can make a potion for you and it will help restore the love in your marriage. And she says, great. And he says, the one thing that I need in order to make this potion is the whisker from the chin of a lion. And she's freaked out. She's like, oh my God, I could get killed trying to find a whisker from the chin of a lion. And he's like, you have to go into the jungle and you have to get this fresh whisker and bring it back to me. That's what I need for this potion. And so she screws up her courage and she gets a little chunk of meat and she sets off on her quest. And she goes over the hills and through the woods and finally ends up deep within the forest, the jungle, where there's a little clearing and she hides behind a tree, and in the clearing is a stream, and there's a wild lion, full-grown, fierce lion, sitting there at the stream drinking water. And so she screws up her courage and she throws the little chunk of meat out into the clearing, and runs away. And the lion eats the meat. She goes back to the village. And some of the versions that I read a day later, some of them a week later, she goes and gets another little chunk of meat. She goes back out into the woods, deep into the forest, goes to the same tree. The lion is there again, drinking water. And this time she leans out a little bit from the tree and she throws the meat and runs away. The next time she gets to the tree and she walks to the edge of the clearing and throws the meat. And then the next time into the clearing. And finally, she is so brave and courageous. She walks right up to the lion and sits beside the lion while he's lapping up water. And she hands him the meat and he eats it. And while he's eating it, she plucks the whisker from his chin and takes it back. And she gets back to the elder in the village and hands him the whisker of the lion. And he's astonished and he says, "I don't need to make a potion. You've had this courage within you all along. Look what you've done. It's amazing. You have the ability within you to create happiness." And I just thought that was a wonderful story, you know, that A, she follows the steps of this hero's journey. It's the process that we all go through. And it's got a little bit of the Wizard of Oz, right?
Yes,
Where
exactly.
nothing realizes she had it within her all the time. So it's that feeling of developing your own strength from within, and that she's able to do that and move forward.
No, yeah, I totally thought of the Wizard of Oz and the ruby slippers, and it's like, nope, you can do it all on your own. But I really enjoyed that tale. I never heard it before, the Ethiopian version, and I agree. It's one of my favorites now. So I know that we are running out of time. So let me ask you my final questions here. What is coming up next for you? Are you working on another book? Do you have talks, classes? What's going on?
Yeah, so I do have a course coming up. It's a new course called Herbs for the Brain. So my herb school, this is a certificate and a CEU approved course for brain and mental health, using herbs and natural foods to support mental clarity, cognition, and brain health. So that's an online course. It's on my website, school.hollybellabono.com. And then I also have a retreat in Italy. I'm co-hosting a 12-day retreat in Tuscany called Herbal Tuscany 2025. And we still have a couple of spots left. That's going to happen in May.
All right. Well, I'll make sure to get this out before then. So, and so people would go for that. Would people go to that same website?
School.hollybellabono.com.
Okay. I will put the link for that in the show notes in the video description. And I will also put links for the book itself there
Thank
too, so
you.
that people can find it pretty easy. So, Holly, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciated it. And I
Yeah, I
very much
enjoyed it so
enjoyed the
much.
conversation. And I like the book. It was a fun read, and I think it was a very interesting and fresh take on the world journey.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it today.
And that's a wrap on episode 185 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now I know you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill. But the thing is, all that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following, these are all free and they only take a few seconds of your time, and they really do help. Subscriber numbers are important, as are followers on podcast platforms. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. A lot of work goes into creating each episode, more than what you might think, several hours every week. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to spread the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.